The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, November 2nd, the Woke Men versus Harassers edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, host of NPR's Invisibilia. And in the New York studios, we have June Thomas, a managing producer of Slate Podcasts. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
You know, Noreen, I feel like just sitting here, I have caught your cold.
Like, oh, God, I'm sorry.
Oh. I'm listening to my voice. I'm like, ugh.
Thought it was just,
right.
Like, cool, sexy voice. Nope, just germ voice, huh?
just nasal germ voice,
yeah.
Exactly. Before we get going, I want to say so thank you to all of you who wrote your gray hair manifestos. Those were awesome. Those were inspiring. I'm just going to read one line from one of them, which was from Rachel Miller, who wrote basically, do whatever the hell you want, what makes you feel good in the morning. And her last line was, and I think, June, you like this one too, don't let society play Delilah to your soul. God, where's that from? That was really nice.
Yeah.
I love that. So thank you, Rachel, and all of you who wrote in. All right, let's get going. What are we going to talk about today? I think we're going to talk about sexual harassment. It is an amazing moment. The particular aspect we're going to talk about is woke men, the men who are around sexual harassment, the men who see it or maybe don't see it or should see it, what's their responsibility? We're going to have on our show Frank Foer, who was the editor of The New Republic at the time that a lot of this was going on, and we'll explain when we get to the segment. Second, we'll talk about gender neutrality. It is everywhere. What is it? What does it mean? And what do we think about it? And then the myth of flexible work. It turns out that it's not so good for women, as two recent studies show. And then in our Slate Plus segment, June, you wanna do it?
Yeah, we'll be asking, are fishnet tights perforce sexist?
Actually, can we broaden that topic?
Of course.
I feel like what's more interesting to me is like less fishnet specifically than like hooker inspired fashion, like literally street walker inspired fashion, which includes fishnets. Is that too?
No, that's
no,
good.
No, it's good. But
okay.
You know, just
yeah, yeah.
So, but just so listeners who don't aren't members of Slate Plus, we know that streetwalkers barely exist anymore. That sex work has moved online, so it's a sort of nostalgic streetwalker fashion, streetwalker chic.
Yeah, well, we'll get to it.
We will.
It's like that's what's interesting about it. Okay, our first topic: sexual harassment. So we have had quite a week. A week which our intern Daniel awesomely called the rapture, where one by one the men are falling. I like that phrase and I like that image. The aspect that we're going to talk about is sexual harassment is not isolated. It exists in a system. It's supported by power structures. And this is one of the things that women are upset about. So our question today is, are the men in the system, are they seeing it? What are they seeing? What's their responsibility in it? So the case we're going to talk about today is the case of Leon Wieseltier, who was the literary editor of The New Republic, a very old magazine. And he was the literary editor for many, many years and wielded a lot of power there, partly by virtue of his relationship with the person funding the magazine, Marty Peretz, and just partly by virtue of his being the longest running editor there and being kind of brilliant and charismatic and having a reputation in cultural circles everywhere for just being a powerful editor. To talk to us about this, we have the very brave Frank Foer. Hi, Frank.
Hey, Hannah.
Frank was the editor of The New Republic. How many years were you the editor, Frank?
I was the editor twice for about, it adds up to about 7 years.
Wow.
7 years. And because Leon Wieseltier, who was recently accused of harassment by several women, incidents that were described amazingly well in an article by The Atlantic by Michelle Cottle, if you want to get a sense of the sort of patterns and how he behaved. But Leon has been there forever. So basically every editor of The New Republic served with Leon dealt with Leon and probably had Leon as a friend. So in addition to that, Noreen and I both worked at The New Republic at very different times. Me in the 90s for several years. And Noreen, when did you work there?
I worked there in 2013, 2014. And Frank was my boss.
Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Frank.
Frank was the boss, not my boss, but Noreen's boss. So, okay, Frank, we are going to put you on the spot a little bit. Let's just start with a basic question. When the news broke about Leon, what was going through your head and your heart? Like, were you shocked? Were you feeling guilty? Like, what were the various things that came to you in that moment?
So, when I first learned, I actually wasn't entirely sure as news arrives, it kind of comes in dribs and drabs. And so I got wind that that there was a group that had formed after the Harvey Weinstein revelations that had begun to discuss Leon and their women's history with Leon. And I learned that there had been stories that had emerged that people were talking about in the open for the first time that were incredibly bruising and that were startling. And
wait, I want to make one quick correction there. Wait, before you continue, because this is a point that Michelle Cottle made in her story. She started her story by making fun of the term open secret, which is a funny term. I know that you meant in the open, meaning like, because it wasn't really in the open when the group were discussing it. It was more just like among themselves. But by in the open, you mean in the press. Because one interesting thing about Leon is that, you know, everybody kind of knew. Like, it wasn't even really a secret. Like, we all talked about it. The women always kind of talked about it.
Well, I guess what I mean by in the open was that it was like, by moving into that discussion group, it was like beyond just something that people whispered to one another, or beyond something that was just, those conversations before happened for sure. But I think that they were more, even if this chat room was kind of behind closed doors, I think it was less behind closed doors than all the discussions over the decades.
Well, this was purposeful, it seemed. I think maybe that's what you're getting at.
Yeah. Yeah,
this was purposeful. Right. Like, a lot of things that have happened this week, it seems like a moment when, in one form or another, women band together, feel more empowered, you know, share stories. There's a kind of unity that was in the Bill Cosby scandal seems to be existing in smaller ways in lots of other little scandals in the media these past few weeks.
Right. So I guess from my perspective, I mean, after the Harvey Weinstein scandal broke, I had talked to friends at the New Republic, and it wasn't like the revelation of that list and that discussion came as a complete shock to me. And kind of I had started to run back in my head, because I'd started to get wind from other reporters and from other members of the extended New Republic community that, you know, did Leon, you know, there was this talk about, like, how did Leon fit this Harvey Weinstein pattern?
And did the men talk about that? Like, do you feel like the men talked about that amongst themselves, or was that just listening to the women talk?
At what point? You mean over the years, or?
No, at first.
Although I'm curious about that, too.
Okay, go ahead. At any point.
Over the years, I don't really think that they did. I think that there was like a high degree of obliviousness to it. It's so hard to know kind of go ahead.
I just don't think that's true, at least not when I was there. I think that a lot of the men on staff knew. I remember jokes about it. I actually searched my GChat and found jokes about Leon's behavior. I wasn't in the D.C. office. I wasn't observing it on a daily basis. But it's a crowd of highly observational people. It seems insane to me that all of these men would not notice something that was happening under their eyes and in some ways, like, for their benefit in a weird kind of power lording way. So that was.
What do you mean by for their benefit, Noreen?
Well, it seems like if you're sexually harassing people in the open, that it's you know, there are a couple kinds of sexually harassing behavior, and one is in secret, and it that's its own psychology. But this was really sort of a public displays of skeeviness, which seemed to me to be just as much about showing other men that you have a kind of power in the office that they don't have, that you are untouchable, that you're the king. And that's sort of my read on that situation. The office dynamics are complicated.
Did you witness something? Or, I mean, what was your firsthand?
No, I mean, I didn't witness anything that I would directly describe as sexual harassment, but I heard stories from other women and from men who worked in the DC office. But there was an air at the New Republic of kind of like, well, that's Leon. Like, you have to, like, the Byzantine power structures of the New Republic are such that you have to, like, Leon survived every editor. Leon picks the editors. Like, you know, this is just what happens. And there was almost an air of shtick about it. By the time I was there. And
Oh, no, Noreen, it was exactly the same when I was there. I mean, one of the things I'm kind of grateful for is that, you know, women your age and younger just, like, have such clear lines around what is harassment and what's acceptable. Like, I feel like the women my age who were there really felt like, well, that's just the system. Like, it never occurred to us that there was any other way to be. Like, there's the sun and the sky and the moon, and that's just how it is, and you just have to deal. And I was just so grateful that people younger have a totally different view, even if it is complicated, because it is complicated. And Michelle Cottle described it in all its complexities, and any woman who worked there could describe it in even more complexities. There's still a kind of bright line, like, this, we call this out. This is not cool in a workplace. And, you know, for that, I am grateful. Like, we didn't think about it like that at all.
And I guess, like, you know, from my perspective, I mean, I, you know, to say that I didn't know about harassment, I think that I need to make a distinction that was maybe important to me then, but is, as I've kind of absorbed the story and talked to women who worked at the New Republic, I think that there was part of it that was kind of out in the open that was culturally accepted, and that was kind of accepted when I arrived, and I just never questioned, which was that there was an element of kind of off-color joking, which was kind of what he did. About everything, that was accepted. And then I think that over the years there was kind of comments objectifying women or talking about appearance. I felt like there were, you know, to my shame, there were a handful of times where I heard him talking about women in the office where I didn't object, or I didn't complain, and I just kind of buried that in my head and didn't really think through the implications or challenge it. So that part is real. I think that there's part of the story that in Michelle's piece that I was either oblivious to or just didn't grasp, or maybe buried my head in the sand. But I think I was largely oblivious to, which was the predatory nature of it all, which as it relates to younger women and the Sarah Wildman incident and so on, you know, all these examples that added up in that piece. And that's the part that I feel like I totally missed. And I understand that there's a connection between these two things.
Frankie, when you were in the room and Liam made one of these comments, what did you do? You just didn't say anything? Did you join in? Did other men join in? I mean, as you were the big boss, did you ever think, wow, this is, you know, what were you thinking? Okay, you said you didn't intervene. Why didn't you? And, like, what was your role in all of this?
I mean, when I heard a comment like that, I think my response was probably shame or, you know, extreme discomfort and kind of wanting to hide or, you know, changing the subject pretty quickly, was my response. And to be clear, it's not like I was, it wasn't like I heard these types of comments, every day, every month. It was things that would be kind of scattered over the course of, you know, many hours, many hours, many months of conversation. I mean, you know, confrontation is hard. I think is part of the grand moral of this entire story, and I wish I shrouded myself in, you know, in doing the right thing and being confrontational in those instances. But really, I was just profoundly uncomfortable.
Well,
and
I have an explanation for why I think it happened, and then I have a confrontation for why I think it bugged people so much. So I think like part of the romance of working at a place like the New Republic or other magazines where I've been talking to people, you know, sort of the literary magazines that still remain, is that you can kind of like screw around and talk about ideas, and it's a small office, and like it's not a corporate atmosphere, right? And like part of the fun of it is that you do get to, you know, drink with your coworkers and talk about ideas, and that was all wrapped up in that. And I think that the Leon mystique very much had something to do with that. But when I saw the men of TNR tweeting their surprise, I guess my feeling was that their surprise must be at how it made people feel more than that it happened, right? That like women would have taken some of these incidents and, you know, taken them to heart in really deep ways. And I think that had more to do with the larger, and this really clicked into place for me with the Leon thing, some of my own frustrations of the New Republic. It had to do with the larger atmosphere of it being a boys' club. I think that it might not have hit people quite as hard had they felt like they had actual opportunity at the New Republic, that they weren't closed out of certain conversations and just not given certain reporting assignments because of their gender. Had, you know, some structural things been in place for women to succeed at the New Republic? I think that is part of what made it so frustrating for people, was that it wasn't a climate where women were treated the same.
I think I agree with you on both points. So with the first, I definitely think that the informality of it was part of what made, you know, gave it its mystique. And it's also part of what makes something like this so difficult, where there's, it doesn't feel like there are necessarily rules or institutional structures. And also, I think that
why weren't there, though? Why wasn't there an HR department at TNR?
I mean, there was this sense that it was too poor to afford one. And I think when, by the time Chris Hughes came in, there was kind of a de facto not HR department, but there were people who handled HR.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, on the other point, I do think that, you know, in the way in which like the last couple weeks have been this kind of, you know, they disrupt the system. Like they cause you to think about everything. At least me, they've caused me to think about so much afresh and to kind of to rewind the tape and to kind of rethink certain assumptions and to also just listen to have pretty tough conversations with my friends and former colleagues. I do think that there is a way in which what you're describing as the boys club culture and the way in which women sometimes felt unseen or treated in as inferior members of the intellectual community. I think that in a way is kind of the toughest part for me to hear, and the one that I think is the, it's like the most, to me it's like the most rattling observation of it all, because to be honest, it's like I you know, there's this gap between your values and lived reality. And so when I came back to the New Republic in 2012 for the second time that I edited, I sincerely, like, I understood that there was a boys club culture. And so I kind of set out to change that. And the fact that that was so difficult, it may, you know, maybe that I failed in that regard, and, you know, made so little progress and ended up, that culture is so powerful, and that, you know, the ways in which maybe even I was trapped in that culture. And
but do you feel like you perpetuated it in any way? Like we were all trapped in it. But do you feel like, what do you think actually happens? That one just like slides along with it? Is that what happens? It's just like, oh, we're back at the New Republic. It's a new era.
I don't know.
But the forces are, I don't know. I mean, the forces are
well,
strong.
I'd be curious to hear Noreen's thoughts on this. But from, you know, from where I sit, it's like I went and I tried to hire women in to create greater gender balance in the staff. I tried to I tried to give women, for instance, a Vita byline count where we tried to get closer to gender balance with our bylines.
I definitely had the sense that you wanted it to be better. But I think that there are structural things that, you know, there were pay disparities that I've since heard about, some of which are sort of shocking. There was no maternity leave. You know, a woman who was pregnant was asked to research her own maternity leave, and the publisher told her that, you know, technically we didn't need to give her any maternity leave.
Yeah.
And you know, that was bad. But then I think, you know.
I helped it, you know, reverse that policy.
Yeah. And that's great. But I think like, I do think on some level you're correct that there are these larger structural forces that do often drag down these efforts. So there were a lot of women hired. They were lower on the totem pole. They weren't sort of in the rooms where decisions were being made. There was sort of one senior woman editor, unless I'm misremembering. You know, I think that there were certain structures that were part of the institution, like the editorial board meetings that for whatever reason favored a certain kind of male argumentation. There was a bias against culture writers. There was an unwillingness to sort of try women on politics in exactly the same way. I think there were little things that had to do with the history of the magazine that made it very complicated. But also, you know, it like the New Republic is a unique institution, but also in some ways just like par for the course. You know, everywhere I've worked has had this problem to a greater or lesser degree. But I will say that the New Republic is the place where it felt most acute. And part of that is because the historical legacy was so present, I would say.
Frankie, I'm curious, you know, and I realize you're in a way you're standing in for the male editors, the male journalists who now, you know, are confessing their obliviousness or their lack of having noticed something.
Yeah, you're being a good sport, Frank. Yes. Thanks.
So, like, what will you do differently next time you're an editor? Or does the fact that you didn't see this massive pattern of discrimination against the women who worked with you or for you disqualify you from being an editor? Or even maybe from, you know, how can you be a good reporter if you didn't even notice that this massive pattern of sexual harassment was going on in the office that you worked in? I mean, again, I'm being very personal to you, but isn't like you are the standing now for men in this profession. This is a profession that's supposed to be about observation. And yet, apparently, you know, a good number of the people working in it were completely unable to observe this massive pattern that was absolutely surrounding them.
I think I've spent a lot of time after this, not so much about, I have really no desire to go back into management ever again. but the sense that Noreen got at in her last comment was kind of the sense that men, the culture of journalism, the culture of intelligentsia, you know, haven't grappled with that, you know, why are Vita counts off? Well, it's cultural, it's historical, but I mean, aren't there ideas about female intelligence that are kind of embodied in a lot of that ingrained bias and in this notion that kind of men have had such difficulty kind of comprehending the culture of their institutions or the damage that they've done to women. I mean, I all I can say is, like, I take, you know, it's once that's kind of, you see that, and your view of the world has been transformed, all you can do is be, I don't know. All I can do is be more curious and open and engaged and try to do better for myself, which is at least now the one thing I can control since I don't run anything.
Now, Noreen, you asked me why, like, I think a lot of people are feeling radicalized. Partly it's because of what Frank said. I myself look back at those years and think, why was that the structure that I lived in? Why did I think it was okay? Why did I think it would never change? But you asked me why I could possibly feel hopeful. Because
that's not what that's sort of what I said. Not exactly.
Well, a lot of people just feel pissed off, so I won't pin this on you. But it is kind of that, like, the seeing clearly moment, mm-hmm. Even if the seeing clearly, like, pisses you off. But the way young women can just kind of, like, draw a box over what happened and name it, I find that hopeful. That's very different from me. I mean, what I was. And then just the ability that, like, now the spot, like, the flashlight is shined. There is, like, you pick people out. I mean, somebody was accused and placed on leave from NPR just yesterday for this reason. So there's just, like, okay, flashlight, flashlight, flashlight. There's just something to be, like, how could you not appreciate that?
Yeah, you know? And I think, like, actually the sort of, you know, the woke man thing, like, that's sort of a mocking phrase a little bit, no offense. But actually, I think that's to me an important thing in this moment, that there are a lot of men who are truly shocked, and like on some level, I'm mad. I'm like, well, why didn't you see that mm-hmm. before? But, like, you know, it wasn't your life. It like this separate thing doesn't necessarily connect to this separate thing, and it didn't even for me until really, in some ways, until watching all the power structures that supported all of this sort of come crashing down a little bit. And I think that actually just having men think it through is a good thing for, you know, society going forward.
And nobody's supporting the men, like, they're being right. fired, right, and placed right. on leave. It's like as soon as one's outed, it's like half a day before the institution does not support them in the way that they did. So that's all yeah. good.
And there are certain structural challenges that, yes, apply in journalism, but also any place where you are rewarded for being a little bit special, for thinking a little bit differently, for expressing your ideas a little bit differently, that can lead, doesn't have to lead, but that can lead to certain people kind of being exempted from the rules.
Mm-hmm.
I never met Leon, and from what I have heard about him, I never wanted to. But clearly, you know, even people who have had horrible experiences with him talk about also his charm and his brilliance. That is a tricky contradiction, and they're maybe not quite behaving like he has behaved. But, you know, whenever there's somebody whose success is based on their seeing things differently and being treated, we tend to treat them differently. And that can be so problematic because we want those people and want to reward them and we want them to do well and do well for us. But, like, you just can't let people have different rules applying to them. Like, we just can't keep doing that.
Yeah. And I will say the other complication in ways in which rules apply differently is that, at least in my day, unlike a lot of the men who were at the top of the New Republic, he was interested in women. And I don't just mean sexually. He was interested in, he mentored, not all of them, you know, but some small number. He was interested in women. He was interested in culture. He was interested in a lot of the things that women were interested in and in kind of nurturing women's careers. So that's like an extra complication to this whole thing.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Anyway, Frank, you have been a sport. Thank you for coming on the show.
My sort of pleasure.
Okay.
That's what all our guests
you
say.
You are free. You may leave the basement now. All right. Bye.
Thanks, Frank.
Bye.
All right. Gender neutrality. So last week, Sam Smith, the singer, came out saying, I am just as much, or I feel just as much woman as I am man. He talked about having women's clothes and high heels in his closet, going years where he didn't wear any male clothing. The headlines called him gender non-binary, although some people objected to that because he didn't call himself gender non-binary. And then on top of that, a lot of gender neutral fashion, gender neutral toys, clothes, schools. And so we're going to talk about this trend first, you know, what's the difference between these two things and what does the trend mean? So who wants to explain the difference?
I can try and June can correct me.
Oh, I don't know.
But gender non-binary is sort of like not believing in some sense in the binary between the genders, that there's a male and a female and that you are, you know, one or the other, whether you've transitioned there or were born there. And gender neutral is more of, to me, maybe I'm incorrect in this, but it seems like more of a teaching concept, like a kind of pedagogy that, like, we are not going to teach children that they are, that there are boy things that boys do and girl things that girls do, that, you know, this is just how humans behave. Like, gender neutral is not a gender category. It's sort of an androgyny of ideas.
And things.
Yeah. You're not going to say this is a boy's shirt. It's a shirt that fits this size of child.
Right, right. And you would never say I'm a gender neutral person because that just doesn't, you know, necessarily make sense.
That's what I thought, is that gender non-binary is an identity. Mm-hmm. Gender neutral is not exactly an identity. It's something you say about objects, like toys are gender neutral, clothes are gender neutral, or it's like a my child rearing is gender neutral or something. But gender non-binary is something you are or feel that you are. So that's the difference. Mm-hmm. They feel very different to me. They feel very differently. Like, one is from the inside and one is from the outside. Like, a parent can decide to raise their child gender neutral but cannot decide that their child is gender non-binary because that's, like, how the child feels or what the child, mm-hmm. you know, you could raise your child gender neutral and get the opposite result, which is a child who's mega gender binary, mm-hmm. just as a, like, screw you mom and dad kind of thing, which has happened in the past.
And then there's gender queer. Which is a more...
Yeah, I mean, I think there are so many terms that I think each person chooses a term that suits them. But I think essentially there's a lot of similarity between these terms. It's just like what each person feels mm-hmm. represents their particular view of themselves. But I think those are the main distinctions.
Well, genderqueer felt more enveloping to me. And then, like, gender non-binary almost feels like an intellectual categorization, like rejection of gender as a concept, whereas genderqueer is kind of like expansive.
Although I feel like we should all be gender non-binary. Like, when I read gender non-binary, I feel like, well, everybody should be that.
Except
the whole world should be that. Like, everybody else is living in a construct. And really, like, if you go through some phase in your life where you don't feel like wearing, you're a guy and you don't feel like wearing guy clothes, then that's fine. It feels to me like we should move to a world where that just is the norm.
You know, it's funny, Hannah, when you started talking, as soon as you said should, I was like, ooh. No shoulds. But then actually, you know, when you finish what you're saying, like, yeah, it's hard to disagree with that. I mean, I think really for a lot of people, whether they identify with their assigned gender or not, or in however many, you know, varying degrees they do, that this whole idea of what girls are supposed to like and be how they're supposed to behave and those ideas are so damaging even to people who don't really have that much quibble with them. Like, it's just this notion of something being imposed from the outside because of tradition or history or just what your mom thinks or what that woman down the street is going to say if you, you know, don't meet the rules. Like, yeah, that's the problem.
Yeah.
It also seems to me more fluid. Like, gender neutral feels rigid to me. Like, I'm going to whenever I read about these experiments, it feels very forced and constructed. Whereas gender non-binary feels like a gentler.
I mean, I know exactly what you mean, but, you know, it's just a matter of what we're used to. Because, yes, you know, any time that you say, I'm going to challenge the status quo, it can sound really hard line and really imposing some strange idea and just being really rigid. But what we're stuck with now is that, you know, like mm-hmm. People, I think, are doing things that can seem to some people like crazy experiments because there's kind of an acceptance of something that when we really look at it is full of bullshit.
Well, and so the experiments that you're talking about are mostly there are experiments that people are doing now in gender-neutral preschools, for instance, and obviously Sweden is at the forefront of this. It's always Sweden. But I was very interested in that, because if you said to me, okay, gender-neutral preschool, I have a bunch of nieces and nephews, and they are so, like, the idea of gender is almost so inherent to the way they see the world. Even if their parents don't want to categorize things, they want to categorize things. They want to know, is this what girls eat? Is this what boys play with? Like, and maybe they are picking it up from social cues, but kids are interested in categories and trying to use people that way. So I was sort of like, well, it seems very, very hard to have a preschool where there that isn't happening. And what these studies seem to show is that, okay, yeah, you're going to sort of fail, okay?
Yeah.
Like, kids will pick up on gender roles, but they will pick up on less of the harmful stuff from them if you don't enforce it in school, if it's just, like, talking about people rather than girls do this and boys do this. And that seems kind of great to me. Like, why aren't we doing that? Like, okay, fine. We can't avoid gender, but...
Yes, yes.
I totally agree. I'm like, I understand that, you know, Sweden is the paragon of all crazy gender experimentation. I get that. On the other hand, I think that feels normal. Like, I guess if your teacher is kind of like, you know, like punishes you if you play with a doll and you're a girl, that's crazy.
Yeah.
You know, but in general, they are always dividing in schools, like boys here, girls here, boys do this, girls do that. Like, no reason for that. There's lots of different ways you can break up a class. And so the more that a school cannot reinforce that that is the distinction between people, why not? You know?
Yeah.
Why not? Just, like, send girls to this game. And they'll still, you're right, Noreen, like, they're still, like, the boys will still go out to the playground and, like, more boys than girls will play football or wall ball or soccer or whatever is going on, and maybe more girls and boys will play tag, but it won't be quite as extreme, I bet.
Right. Or it won't feel enforced. It won't feel like, yeah, this is how you're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
It'll just be what you feel like doing, or it's more likely to be that way.
Totally.
What do you guys think of the gender-neutral fashion? Like, I picked up my Vogue magazine this summer, and there's, like, Gigi Haddad and Zayn Malik. They're, like, switch clothes, and I wear his clothes. Is that all just totally performative bullshit?
I mean, I don't know. It's hard to say, right, if it's performative bullshit, but I'm very aware that it's only possible if you are the exact, you know, model size. I mean, I really like men's...
June, you're an androgynous fashion icon.
I think of myself as a cross-dresser because I like men's clothes. For myself, I don't really like women's clothes, but I have to concede that they really don't necessarily fit me or suit me. You know what I mean? Obviously, you can make things fit, but, like, fashions are designed for a certain body type. And if you don't have that body type, you're going to be a little bit off the, you know, you're not going to be right on. And I think, so what, that's what I mean about these, like, when we see them in fashion magazines, it's fashion magazine fashion.
Right.
And looks.
And androgynous fashion has been around, you know, for a long time. And in the sort of modern era, Coco Chanel started it. And it was like, skinny, flat-chested women looked incredible in the clothes that she made.
Right.
But there is, like, sort of a privilege to being able to pull it off.
Yeah.
I would say that androgynous fashion going one direction has been around for a long time.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the thing that's relatively new is men wearing skirts, like men sort of feeling free to wear women's clothing. But women who are, I mean, even the term tomboy, which my son was asking me about, like, when I'm a tom girl now, I'm like, well, why is that even a term? Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So come on, boys, wear skirts. Wear skirts.
That one's going to be slower to catch on, I think. But give it 25 years. I'm serious. Like, that'll happen.
And makeup, too.
And you're missing out, boys, by the way, I would say.
Skirts are the best.
Super comfortable. They're the best. So are dresses. Anyway, listeners, if you have any experience, I'm actually very curious about gender-neutral child rearing. But if you have any kind of personal experiments, little things you've done to either raise kids gender neutral or yourself kind of move towards more gender non-binary, I don't know, presentation, thinking, whatever, write us at XXGabFest@slate.com. All right. The myth of flexible work. So we dream about flexible hours as the answer to many of our problems, whether you have children or don't have children. It seems really awesome and tempting to not live by the office clock. So now we have two studies which show that flexible work is a great disappointment, and particularly to women. One in Germany, which shows that it's good for men, but not really good for women. And most of the studies show that it increases hours for everybody. Have you guys ever worked flexibly?
I mean, I feel like I do all the time. Like, I can work from home if I want. I can work on the weekends if I want. You know, I can work all the hours I want. And I don't, nobody is forcing me to. So I guess I feel like I really do have a very flexible work schedule. I mean, I think it's often the case for so-called knowledge workers like us.
Yeah. I when I was a writer, I worked flexibly. But at my current workplace, my boss likes FaceTime. So you sort of have to be in the office. Which can be annoying. Commuting.
Yeah, I mean, there are two things that came out of these studies. One applies to everybody, thus a gender-neutral conclusion. Mm-hmm. And one, see how I use that term? Like
beautifully,
all
beautifully.
And
what a pro.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks. And the other one is just for women. The one that's for women I'll talk about first, because it's kind of expected and depressing, which is especially in Germany, they kind of reward the men. Like, they think it's great when men do it. This now I remember that Anne-Marie Slaughter article in The Atlantic, where it's like if a dude is saying, like, I ran a marathon, and so everybody's like, oh, he takes time off to train for his marathon, and that's really cool. But if women ask for flexible work to do, you know, domestic stuff, it's kind of frowned upon. So I think in the German study, the men ended up getting paid more, like rewarded more. And then also working class women did not get, were sort of frowned upon when they asked for flexible hours.
Right. I mean, yeah, there's two things there, which is that it was interesting that in that German situation, it was expected and kind of employees expected and rewarded the fact that, like, guys would take classes or do something like for themselves, improve themselves, make themselves more desirable employees, but that women would kind of do caregiving, whether it was for their kids or some part of their families. And so it was, you know, it was almost like the men are going to become better employees for doing this, but the women are going to become worse employees. That was how employers thought, which is devastating. And then the second thing is that this really does seem like a middle class thing, because it's, I mean, just on a kind of organizational basis, like, it's actually fine if I'm working, you know, if I do, so, you know, as long as I'm, you know, not keeping people waiting, or as long as I'm, you know, working well with my coworkers, that's fine. It doesn't really matter when I do my work. But if you work in a shop, or if you're a nurse, or if you are a caregiver, or if it's any kind of thing where you must be there at that time, obviously flexibility is not by any means impossible, but it is just far more difficult to organize and far less likely to be allowed.
Although I feel like the workplace could catch up to that, because there's all sorts of ways you can split shifts. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, doctors can't really work flexibly. They have to see their patients just as nurses have to see their patients. Mm-hmm. But there is a kind of human need not to always completely be bound to the office clock, no matter who you are. It just seems to be a human need.
Absolutely.
Like, life doesn't necessarily operate that way. Do you think that the conclusion of the German study, I mean, when people wrote about this, they sort of, there was a strain of, like, it's Germany's fault, like, Germany's just not woke enough. And I wonder if, like, the culture comes first and then the structure. That's one thing I was trying to figure out. Or does the structure drive, we tend to think structure drives culture. So you just institute a policy, like, let's say we instituted maternity leave, God forbid, in America, paid maternity leave, then, like, the culture will follow that. But this seemed to indicate that it doesn't work that way. That's what was depressing about this study, that, like, you kind of have to change people's attitudes, or the policy changes that you make just end up reinforcing whatever cultural stereotypes already are there.
Right. Bad news for famously woke America, you know? Yeah. I found this so depressing. I mean, it just seems like flexible work has been held up as this ideal for how, you know, we are going to solve the problem of women getting left behind a little bit in the office when they have kids. And this, like, it makes sense to me that it doesn't actually work once you see the studies laid out in this way. There are startups now that are trying to connect women, that are trying to basically facilitate flexible work for women. And a year ago, I think I might have said, oh, that's a good idea. But now that I've read this study, I'm like, I don't know. Is that actually the best way to sort of, you know, push women ahead in the workplace, is by perpetuating this? I just don't, like, what's So what goes after flexible care if this isn't the solution?
I will say that flexible work saved my life. Like, yeah. It worked out well for me. And I realized I was completely, completely lucky in that sense. But, you know, I was working at The Washington Post when my children were born. And I just realized, like, that sort of, you know, the FaceTime being at the office, like, it was killing me. Mm. And it felt unnecessary. And so that's when I dropped back and became a freelancer. Now, it worked out. I was a freelancer. Like, I got contract work. I realized that's a total position of privilege, but it does break my heart that's like, I just didn't, you know, when you're new to child rearing, especially, it just feels hard,
yeah,
sometimes to live by those hours.
There was an article in Slate where someone talked with an expert on European attitudes to flexible work, and there was one story that filled me with a little bit of optimism, and that was the Netherlands. Apparently, you know, the Dutch are very strict, like they will work 36 hours in a week. They are not working more, and they're very productive in those 36 hours. They're among the most productive people in the world, and then they leave work behind. And that is clearly like an attitude that is broadly felt. And it's funny because oftentimes when attitudes are broadly felt, I think, oh, that's wrong then. and yet when it suits me, I like it. But it does feel like if for real, and not just as something that people say, if for real you're going to go to work, you're going to do your work, and then it's going to be done, like that actually seems like the best situation.
Yeah, get back at me when some of this stuff is replicated outside of Scandinavia, I guess, is my takeaway from today.
No, but that's actually an anti-flexible work art. That's the thing I found most interesting about these.
No, it's anti-flexible
work.
Absolutely.
Articles.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just that no matter who, this is the part that's gender neutral. Flexible work is kind of bullshit because everybody ends up working a ton more. So it's this kind of American idea. Flexible work just means infinite work. And this is because this gets into kind of, you know, rational biases. This is because we are not rational beings, and we have a terrible time kind of predicting like how much time something is going to take. And we also we make the wrong decisions minute to minute. So even if you start the day saying, I'm only going to work this amount, in the moment, you feel like, oh, I have to answer those 26 more emails right now. Mm-hmm. And so because in America, there's a culture of like just more work, you people who commit to flexible work just end up working all the time, which was interesting.
It really was. And I kind of think it doesn't have to be. You know, I think, you're right. We don't really learn. We, especially in this country, we really do not learn from the examples of other countries. But maybe we should try, you know, and you can't just try it, too, because it has to be really serious, like to be really serious about it. And I have to say, too, that, you know, as somebody who doesn't have, like, nobody could be more privileged with their time than me. Like, I don't have kids. I don't have family members I have to look out for. I'm really very, you know, it's just me. I'm very selfish. And I often will do a little bit of work late at night or early in the morning because it gets it off my like cognitive load, I think is the is the jargon term. And so, and that makes me feel good. So like I sleep better knowing that I've taken care of something. So I would have a very hard time moving away from that if I could only work in the office and only during those hours. That would be really hard for me. But you know what? It sounds like it might be better overall.
All right. So everyone listening to this show, stop working. Put it all down. Stop. Just go home.
Turn your brain off.
Turn your brain off. Promise yourself you'll turn your brain off by a certain time and then just do it. All right. So let's do our recommendations. Noreen, what do you have?
I have two recommendations. One is a podcast that I think I recommended in its first season when it was based in New York. Now it's in LA. It's called There Goes the Neighborhood, and it's a podcast about gentrification and the way that it works sort of on the ground level, interviewing people in what are euphemistically known as changing neighborhoods, both the people who are coming in and the people who are getting pushed out. And it's really well done. And then the other recommendation, I last weekend watched American Gigolo, and I just want to recommend a young Richard Gere. That's all I got.
Just like as a physical specimen, just, or as an actor, or
if you want to turn off your brain, you know, you've done your flexible work for the week. Just sit back and watch young Richard Gere in Armani's suits with this weird. I mean, he's Yeah. Just kind of fun.
I interviewed Richard Gere, and I will never forget it. It was a Dalai Lama conference.
Wow.
And he was sitting in the front row. And I interviewed a bunch of celebrities, and he was one of them. He is like one sexy, charismatic guy, like in the flesh as well as on the screen. He just is.
All right.
Well, I'm going to recommend a book called Code Girls by a friend of mine, Liza Mundy. It is the untold story of the American women codebreakers of World War II. It's in the tradition of Hidden Figures. It's just a fascinating untold story, which she unearthed from all these archives of these women who were almost secretly recruited, mm-hmm. like from women's colleges in various places, to be code breakers, and just the sisterhood of the code breakers, which nobody knew about. And she found some kind of last remaining members of that group. And it's just fascinating to just think about why that would be kept in secret and how it was all gathered and sort of who the women were and what their social norms were then. It's a really fabulous book.
I'm so interested in that. You know, in Britain, the women of Bletchley Park and men too became famous, and there's lots of cultural representations of them, including kind of mysteries that take advantage of the idea that these women had to pretend that they really hadn't done anything in the war, when in fact they were doing this really important and really clever war work. And it's funny that that hasn't really been brought out with the American aspect of that. So I'm really keen to read that book.
Yeah, it's just like a little blank spot, you know, because it's a similar kind of vibe. Like why it was supposed to be like, oh, we're just secretaries.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
June.
I'm afraid I'm going to go with a really obvious recommendation. But I finally finished American Vandal this weekend. And I started it just because people were watching it and talking about it. And like they kept talking. So it's a show that's kind of a satirical view of like true crime shows, podcasts, but it wears its satire incredibly lightly. And essentially, it's about who did the digs. Somebody vandalizes cars in a high school by drawing penises on them. And it's just completely committed. The actors are amazing and they're completely believable as high schoolers. And after like two or three episodes, you're like, why am I watching this? And then by like six or seven, you're like, oh my God, let this never end. And it's so well done. If you think it might be a bit too childish and doodly for you, I really recommend you give it a chance because it's really so fun.
That, you know, I totally thought it was too childish and doodly because I saw all the ads for it.
I know.
And I was like, that's for juvenile dudes.
Yeah.
But I'm totally going to watch it now.
It's really fun. And I mean, I hate to say to people, stick with it, because like that essentially is saying, please waste your time if you're not liking something, which is stupid. But it really is one of those things that like the more you sit with it, the more amazing it gets.
Well, great.
And before we leave you today, I just want to just recommend the Audio Book Club, which is one of Slate's longest running podcasts. It's now run by the amazing Katie Waldman, who, if you are a reader of Slate, you will be a huge fan of her work, I feel certain. So the Audio Book Club is a monthly discussion of a book. It's as simple as that, but it is always so stimulating. The latest edition was a discussion of Hillary Clinton's What Happened, which I think our listeners are going to be interested in. Katie discussed it with Megan O'Rourke and Emily Bazelon, and it's definitely worth your time. And the month after, at the end of November, they are going to be talking about Manhattan Beach by Jennifer Egan, another book that I know a lot of people are super interested in talking about with their friends. Well, if your friends haven't read it, then you can kind of be involved in the conversation with the Audio Book Club, which you can find among the Slate podcasts.
Great. All right. Well, that's our show for today. Thank you, as always, to our wonderful producer, Verilyn Williams, to our wonderful intern, also part producer, Daniel Schrader. The executive producer of Slate Podcasts is Steve Lickteig. We thank him, too, because we don't thank him enough. And listeners, today we're going to ask you, take some time to rate and review the show in Apple Podcasts. Good reviews and ratings are really helpful to us. They help our visibility. They help people discover our show and listen, just like you're doing. So please do that if you can. So that's the show for June and Noreen. I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you in 2 weeks. Bye.